This podcast is a production of the San Francisco Chronicle. My name is Nanette Asimov, and I cover education for the San Francisco Chronicle. Today I'm talking with Lori Lebo, author of The Devil in Dover, an insider's story of dogma versus Darwin in small-town America. In 2004, Lebo was a reporter for the York Daily Record near Dover, Pennsylvania, when the local school board earned itself a dubious honor. It became the first in the country to require that biology teachers introduce religious ideas in the classroom while casting doubt on basic scientific concepts. Christianity is serious business in Dover, but the idea of supplanting science with the supernatural angered many parents. So in 2005, with the help of the ACLU and the National Center for Science Education in Oakland, the parents sued to stop the religious requirement. The case was called Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District. In her new book about the case, Lebo not only helps readers understand the best public defense of evolution since the Scopes monkey trial of 1925, she shows how the issue bitterly divided the town and threatened her own relationship with her father, the evangelical host of a Christian radio station near Dover. So the case centers on something called intelligent design. What is that, and how did the Dover School Board come to embrace that?
Well, when the Dover Area School Board started talking about evolutionary theory, their first words were about creationism. And this all began at some public school board meetings in June 2004 when there was a search for a new biology textbook for ninth grade students. One of the parents had been standing up at school board meetings and asking why they hadn't adopted it. Bill Buckingham, who was on the textbook search, who was heading up the textbook search committee at the time, said he objected to the book that was recommended by the science department of the school district. He objected to it because it was laced with Darwinism. At that meeting and at another meeting also that month, school board members spoke of their desire to require the teaching of evolutionary theory with creationism. And at one point, Bill Buckingham said, 2,000 years ago on the cross, somebody died. Won't somebody stand up for him? And this, at the time, it drew a lot of outrage in the community. And two newspaper reporters had reported their remarks in the next day's newspapers. It's really interesting that what happened, though, somewhere in between the June meetings and July, the school board members stopped talking about creationism, and they started talking about intelligent design, which is essentially revamped creationism. It's the idea that life is so complex that it demands a guiding hand. The school board members that I was talking to at the time said that they felt that this was a reasonable compromise between their religious views and what the U.S. Supreme Court would allow.
So what did the school board actually want teachers to do?
The nuts and bolts of it was that they wanted, they had crafted a four-paragraph statement that was to be read to students at the very beginning of the chapter where they discuss evolutionary theory. Basically, it's a four-paragraph statement that raises lots of questions about evolution, says that it is, only a theory and not a fact, and that there are other theories of, how we've gotten here today, including intelligent design. Then the students were referred to a textbook that was being kept in the library called Of Pandas and People. It's really interesting about this four-paragraph statement. The school board said that they were never teaching it. They were merely making students aware of it and that it was the students were never allowed to ask questions about it, too. So the teachers balked at this because they felt that it was, they said intelligent design was not a scientific theory and would go against their, ethics to teach students something that they believed was not science. So what happened was they refused to, and the administrator stepped in and read the four-paragraph statement. At this point, a lawsuit had been filed by parents.
The U.S. Constitution prohibits state-sponsored religion, and the Supreme Court said in 1987 that you can't teach creationism in public school. So why did the school board think that it could get away with intelligent design?
Well, they were getting some help from a law firm called the Thomas More Law Center. Following the June board meetings, they were contacted by a member of the Law Center, which is an organization that pledges to be the sword and the shield for Christians. Dick Thompson, who heads up the Law Center, had been looking for a test case on intelligent design. He had been shopping around to school districts around the country, including one in West Virginia, asking them to adopt intelligent design into their science curriculum. And he said, "You will most definitely be sued for this, but in exchange for doing this, for being the foot soldiers in the culture wars to return God into school, public schools, we will defend you for free." So they were getting a lot of help. They were being told this. An interesting aspect of this was that the school district's attorney at the time had said, "You can't do this. You've been talking about creationism. You know, your record that you are motivated by religion is quite clear in this case. So it's a very high likelihood you will lose this lawsuit if you get involved in it." The school board members listened to their attorney and basically said, "You know what? You don't need to come to board meetings anymore. We've got somebody who's going to help us out." Honestly, the brazenness of what the school board was doing is quite amazing in this case. They thought they could go, you know, the goal was to take this case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Basically, you're saying they pretended it wasn't creationism.
Very much so, yes. Even though, well, they at first, you know, they had been talking about creationism. They were quite clear. They had talked to me about creationism. They had said that, you know, this is what they believe. They believe that the earth is 6,000 years old. They believe that man walked with dinosaurs. They believe in the flood. The great flood is responsible for the entire fossil record. This is what they were sure of. However, they also knew that because of the court record in this, that they could not push God into science class, so they needed something a little bit sneakier, and this is what intelligent design was. It's a concept that had been changed after creation science was struck down by the Supreme Court.
One of the things that's so interesting about your book is that you grew up just outside of Dover, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
You really know the people there and you know the town. So what kind of a place is Dover?
You know, we're hearing so much about small towns these days and about it being the real America. And, you know, of course, that's just silly. Small towns are like big cities. I mean, we have the same characters in all of this. It's a conservative area. That's definitely true. But there's also people who embrace the Constitution, and there are people who believe that teaching their children about God is their constitutional right and not the right of the school board. And they hold these values quite dear. But I guess one of the main differences then maybe, in a small town is that a lot of people know each other and you run into each other and you see each other at the grocery store and the pizza shop. You know, you serve on the PTO together. So you do have that element of it. However, there's also been, in addition to it being a small community whose roots go way back, as a matter of fact, one of the plaintiffs in the case, his family roots goes back to the William Penn Grants in the 1600s. And his ancestors are buried underneath tombstones written in German, Pennsylvania German. In addition to these deep roots, there's also a lot of people who have been moving in from Maryland and other areas looking for the low taxes in the school. So there is a lot of change going on, too, at the same time. And that may have prompted some of the tension in the community.
Well, you have a chapter in the book that you call Neighbor Against Neighbor. So how hard was it for parents who presumably grew up in this town and knew their neighbors, were friendly with their neighbors, to find each other and go against the school board in Dover and other neighbors?
For some of them, it was it was quite difficult. Nobody wants, you know, to be the one to ban God. A lot of them were really afraid that they would be the people that were banning God from their community. And that's not what this case was about. A lot of the plaintiffs are very active in their churches. Christy and Brian Rehm sing choir every Sunday and teach summer vacation Bible school. But again, they believe that this was about, you know, they believe in science, and they believe that teaching their children about God was their constitutional right. The interesting thing in this case was that these parents came together, but they didn't know each other at first. What it was the ACLU was looking for people to volunteer to be plaintiffs in this case. And one by one, 11 parents did come forward. And they had never met each other before, even though it's a small community. So it was kind of strange. And they didn't know that these other parents were out there. But then once they did, they formed a really strong bond with them. Because sometimes you can feel, and as one who did grow up in the area, sometimes you do feel like you're the only person thinking a certain way. And everybody else is marching in lockstep to a different philosophy.
Now, big themes in your book are hypocrisy and self-righteousness.
Yes.
How did this case bring those issues out into the open?
One of the most painful elements of this case, at least for me, was watching how the school board members ultimately lied about what they had said. They had talked about creationism at these school board meetings, yet when it came time to give their depositions, they denied ever making these remarks. Now, making this worse was that their remarks had been recorded in the newspapers by two reporters, Joe Maldonado and Heidi Bernhard Bubb, who are both very good reporters, and I had worked with them before this. And they just said that Joe and Heidi had made up the remarks, that they had lied. And, I mean, they slandered them. And what makes... To make this even worse is that Heidi is a Mormon and a very devout Christian, and at the school board meetings at the time that she was reporting this, she was also very much pregnant. I think, I'm trying to think if she was like 6 months pregnant at the time. And Joe Maldonado was raised a Baptist and formed the Bible club in his high school. So these are reporters of very deep faith, and the school board members just said, nope, they're liars. They're liars. As a matter of fact, and I wrote about this in the book, at one point during a school board meeting, I was sitting there next to Joe when the president of the school board said publicly that the only reason why Joe was reporting this stuff was he was trying to sell more newspapers so he could make more money to send his son to college. And I sat there next to Joe watching him, realizing that he had just been publicly slandered. And as a journalist, you aren't supposed to be drawn into the story. So he just sat there and had to take it. And I couldn't offer any word of defense either. It was horrible. I mean, everybody in the audience, there were like, it was like 100 people that day, just groaned. I mean, even they were, you know, were appalled at what this was. And I looked over at Joe, and his ears were bright red. And he told me later he was counting down from 100 to control his anger.
This also has some very personal meaning to you. Your father, Dean Lebo, was an evangelical who ran a Christian radio station just north of Dover.
Yes.
And you say that you and your family are mainly agnostics. So what was that like for you, and how did your coverage of this case affect your personal relationship with your father?
My father was, you know, as he has five kids, and he was always terrified that his, that if we, as a born-again Christian, that if we, he feared that if we did not believe as he did, that we would be going to hell. I mean, it's a basic evangelical tenet. You must be washed in the blood of Christ to reach salvation. And he truly believed this. So when he became born again, it was about 10 years before he passed away, he had... he was reaching out. He would try to reach out to his children and get us to accept that. I understood his fear. I really did. So for many years, I pretended that I believed along with him, because I can understand. I mean, I honestly believe that if you believe that you have to accept all the basics of his faith, otherwise you're going to hell, then I can't believe that anything else would matter. I can't believe the First Amendment would matter. I can't believe that science would matter. I mean, the only thing that matters is that you know that you will be reunited with the people you love most in this world. So I understood that. However, when I was dealing with the board members' lies and the deception of the outside groups that were involved in this, the Discovery Institute, who were pushing intelligent design, and the Thomas More Law Center and their deception. I would come to my father and I'd say, look, they're lying. They're not being truthful. You know, they're slandering, you know, fellow Christians in this. And he would never denounce that. He would never say, well, you know, you can't lie in the name of Jesus. And that really bothered me. And I found it harder and harder to play along with that I believed as he did. And pretty much, you know, during the trial, I stopped trying. And which became a very painful moment for me later on. And I still am not sure if I know if I did the right thing. But, you know, I was caught up in that. And I just couldn't, that he would not denounce the lying just made me unable to play along with his, you know, needs.
Now, the judge in this case was John Jones.
Yes.
A Bush appointee and a Republican.
Yes.
And because of that, the defendants felt confident that he would rule in their favor. What happened?
Well, there was a lot of talk, yes. And a lot of the pro-intelligent design groups were thrilled that he was the judge that would be, you know, the one doing it. As a matter of fact, they speculated wildly that he was going to be, you know, he was in their pocket. So, yes, there was much excitement over this. It's interesting, the plaintiff's attorneys never knew what to think. I mean, they were always very cautious on where he was going with this. And as the trial progressed, there was a lot of time spent watching the judge to see how he reacted to everything. I know I was sitting in there, and the other journalists, we were all watching him and going, well, what do you think about this? What do you think he's thinking here? He was very much engaged, and that's what we did notice. When there was some fascinating scientific testimony going on, he was leaning forward with the rest of us because it was an amazing trial watching all this incredible science happening in front, you know, as they explained the fossil record and they explained the human genomes, you know, the discussion of all this. It was just really fun, and Judge Jones seemed to be fascinated by this as well. So by the end of the trial, we were never sure, you know, like, well, is he, you know, we knew he was appreciating what was being said, but we weren't, you know, sure that,
Okay, but tell us what he ruled.
At the end, he, said that not only had the board members lied, and he chided the breathtaking inanity of what the board members had done, in terms of, trying to push this, push their religious views into science class and doing it so unprepared. I mean, he was struck by the fact that even one of the board members who was actively championing intelligent design couldn't even during her testimony pronounce it properly. She kept calling it intelligence design. It was really frustrating to watch. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I were getting up on the stand, I would have done at least enough homework to at least define the concept and say what it is. But, you know, that's me. So he had chided what they had done. But, and this was the big question at the end of the trial, would he, in addition to noting the dishonesty of what had been said by the board members, but would he also rule that intelligent design was not science? And that is what he ultimately did. He called it an interesting, you know, philosophical discussion, but it definitely was not science.
And so the impact of that ruling, does it go beyond the Dover area schools? Does it affect other school districts?
It only affects Dover, actually. I mean, in terms of precedent, court precedent, it's just Dover. However, outside Dover, we've noticed a lot of school districts have been paying attention, and they are being, right after the trial, Ohio was going through a big case and with their state standards. And 1 month later, they took the intelligent design-friendly curriculum guidelines out. So there has been several repercussions that have played out since then where the school boards realize that they do not want to get involved in a costly lawsuit. Ultimately, this cost Dover taxpayers $1 million. And in a small community, that can have a big impact on your tax base. So there has been... school districts are paying heed. However, this battle is not over. What we're seeing now is a big challenges in Texas and challenges in Louisiana right now, and we expect other ones, under the guise of academic freedom and teach the controversy.
Well, we will keep an eye on this. It's fascinating stuff. I want to thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Lori Lebo will be talking about her book, The Devil in Dover, and signing copies on Wednesday, October 29th at 6:30 p.m. at the San Francisco Public Library Main Branch. And Lori, where can we find out more about your book?
My website is devilindover.com, and it also includes information on this issue as, you know, and where it's going as well.
Thank you. This is Nanette Asimov. Please look for my interview with Lori Lebo later this week in Datebook or sfgate.com.